This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And boy, oh boy, are we going to hear the story behind a book today. This is so exciting. Wow. I have on the phone today Joel C. Rosenberg, and this is so exciting for me. I am just so thrilled to welcome you to the program today, Joel.
Well, it's great to be with you. Shalom from Jerusalem.
Well, shalom to you. Oh, wow. You know, I on March 16th, it is going to be the 6th anniversary of Joy on Paper. And when I started this program, I had no idea that I would be talking to so many. When I started it, I didn't know anybody in the business, and I didn't know any writers. Over the years, I've spoken to so many people, but I don't think anyone is as, I don't know, prestigious as you. I don't think I've ever had anyone, although I've had over 300 New York Times bestsellers, selling authors, and of course, you are one of them, and 11 Mystery Writer of America Grandmasters, and even the U.S. Poet Laureate, but you are really special. Wow. You are the only one I know, the only author I've ever had on the program who could stand up and talk in front of the President of the United States or the Prime Minister of Israel and and sort of fill them in on things that are going on. And so you are really, it's a thrill to talk to you and also to just talk about this book, The Beirut Protocol, which I enjoy so much.
Well, thank you so much. It's very kind of you to say that. I'm honored to be on your program. And, you know, when I first started writing novels almost 20 years ago, I never expected to be on the New York Times bestseller lists or to have my books read by world leaders, American leaders. You write your first novel, you just want your mother to be able to find the book at a bookstore within 100 miles of her house, right? You're not thinking of much more than that, but it's been an exciting career, and I'm amazed by the doors that have opened, and I get to talk to all kinds of interesting people, yourself included.
Well, you certainly... You have spoken to everybody, I think, and everybody would like to speak to you. And I love that plug for your mother, and because I love, it's so funny. Marcus Ryker, of course, is a really tough guy. This series, this is your fourth book, and Marcus Ryker is a tough guy, but oh, he loves his mother. And as a mother, I get a kick out of that. I really like him for that.
Well, you'll like this story then. So I've been writing for 20 years, and there's 16 novels now, and there's 5 million in print. But this new series about Marcus Ryker, you're right, this is the fourth novel now, The Beirut Protocol. But in the first novel in the series, which is called The Kremlin Conspiracy, that's where we really meet Marcus, right? He's actually in college at that point. He's fallen in love with his high school sweetheart. We're getting his backstory, and he loves his mother. You're right, and is willing to do anything to defend her. I won't give it away.
No,
but there's a line that his mother says to Marcus, which is because he's such an adventurer and he loves risk and he loves jumping out of airplanes and whitewater rafting in Colorado, and he loves adrenaline, right? He loves taking risks, and she always says to him when he leaves the house, Marcus, don't die and don't get arrested. Now, that line is actually a real line that I used to say to one of my sons. I have four sons. My wife and I raised them mostly in Virginia, but now we've been here in Israel for 7 years almost. And this one son is Marcus Ryker. He is in Israeli Special Forces right now, and this kid loves risk-taking so much that I used to say to him every time he left the house, don't die and don't get arrested, because all the things you want to do in your future will not work if one of those two things happens. So we pull from real life sometimes.
That's it. Well, I do love that part. I get a kick out of it every time, because, you know, being a mom and knowing that your kid is going to grow up to be a mensch, and you know, that's what you want.
Well, you hope they're going to grow up to be a mensch. You've got to work your way through all that adolescence.
Oh, yeah.
All that testosterone when you're raising boys. We didn't get the spiritual gift of raising teenage daughters, so God must have looked at us and gone, I don't think that's going to work.
Well, I think it's worked out pretty well for you. And you, I mean, as I said, you know, I've spoken to so many people now. It's getting, you know, having the 6th anniversary of the program is really a big deal, you know, to have done all of this. But really, you are so impressive, and that you have spoken at the White House, and that you have are dealing with, you know, global level talks is fascinating. And one of the things I've discovered particularly over the past year during this pandemic, my listeners, who are all great readers, they write to me, and more they're saying, thank you for recommending that book. Not just because it's a great book, but because I learned something. I think there's this need now in people. They want it. They're over all the television, and they want to learn something. They want to be left with something, you know. In addition to having a good book, they want something out of it. And with this book, they certainly will, because you weave a wonderful story. You know, you're a great writer, but in between all of the storyline and all of the action, and believe me, there's action, you tell something important here. And for those of, you know, I have some younger listeners, you know, the ones in their 20s, they're not even aware, probably, of where Beirut is. And then, of course, the older ones who have this recollection, some of them do actually remember that Beirut was once a Paris. It was once a glorious city. So tell us, you know, set the stage here, what you want to tell about the book, and then tell the listeners something about Beirut and why it's such a tragedy of what's going on there.
It's really true. I'm happy to do it. Great question. So let's start with the setup. What is the Beirut Protocol? So Marcus Riker, as we said, is the hero. He is a decorated, honored combat veteran in the Marines, served multiple combat tours in Afghanistan and Iraq. Wounded in battle, heroic in battle, but he recovers and he goes on to work for the United States Secret Service. He rises to become part of the elite presidential protective detail, you know, protecting the President of the United States and world leaders who are visiting. So this guy is at the top of the top, right? He's not an assassin. He's not Jason Bourne. He's not Mitch Rapp from the Vince Flynn series. He's not, you know, the lead character in Brad Thor's books. He is not an assassin. He's a killer if he has to. But by training and personality, Marcus Riker is a protector. He's a defender. He works for the Secret Service. He did. And then some tragedy happens in his life, and he leaves government service. Well, when he's drawn back in because of other events that have happened in previous books, I won't get into it now unless you want to, but he now is working for the CIA. And as the Beirut Protocol begins, Marcus and his team are on the Israeli-Lebanon border. Why? Because the U.S. Secretary of State is coming to the region. She's working on a peace treaty between the Israelis and the Saudis. And she's worried that Iran is the major threat in the region, could try to blow up the peace process. And it's not just Iran. Iran has terror proxy forces like Hezbollah, the terrorist force in Lebanon. So the Secretary of State wants to go up to the Israeli-Lebanon border and get a briefing and take a tour and find out just how serious is this threat. And Marcus is doing an advance trip to make sure everything is going to be safe. Well, chapter one, opening scene of the Beirut Protocol, boom, there's a big terror attack on that border. Marcus and his team get in a firefight with a Hezbollah terror cell. And when the smoke clears, Marcus and his team have been captured, pulled into a terror tunnel deep underground, and pulled deep into Lebanon, deep behind enemy lines. That's how the Beirut Protocol begins. And while Marcus and his team are underground being tortured and you know, held hostage, a massive war is erupting above them. And that is, a thriller writer is supposed to thrill. My main goal in life is not to educate, right? If I don't make your pulse quicken, if I do not make your heart pound, if I do not keep you up all night reading my chapters until 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, and now you're cursing me on Twitter and Facebook, how dare you? I've got to go to work. I've got to go to school. If I haven't done that, then nothing else that I do matters, because it's a thriller. You have to thrill.
I know.
But I think people don't only want to be educated or entertained. They do. But they, you can't binge watch Netflix all day every day, right?
No.
But they also want to learn something. And in my thrillers, I take them into the type of worst case scenarios that we all pray never happen, but could happen. And I take you into a world that everybody knows that the Middle East is dangerous, and there are things that we ought to know about those dangers. We don't really want to read a 900-page nonfiction book about, radical Islamism and Middle Eastern history. We want to read a thriller, and if I can learn and be entertained, well, then hallelujah.
Exactly. Well, that's what you do. I mean, the thriller, now, I am very lucky with my reading. I start reading at 4:30 in the morning, usually. I wake up early. I'm a farm girl, so early morning. I have my first cup of coffee, and then I start reading. So I started reading this book. I was like, it was 5 o'clock in the morning, so it took all Sunday, my whole Sunday. All of the other things went aside. No cooking, no laundry, no cleaning, no anything. And I always do my cooking.
Sorry for the rest of your family.
That's right. I always do my cooking on Sunday. My mother-in-law taught me that. She was Israeli, and she came to America on her first trip to America. And she saw me shopping and cooking every day, shopping and cooking every day. She kept saying, "What are you doing? Cook on Sunday." No, do it. Finish. So I usually do that. So there I am reading this book. I can't put it down. It's exactly that. It is really exciting. A lot convoluted. A lot, several different storylines going on, but all fascinating.
Well, as you know, I try to write short, intense chapters with cliffhanger endings. And so, it's now 2 o'clock in the morning, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, like, thinking, I really ought to go to get some sleep, but, I just want to know what happens next. Oh, this next chapter is short. I'll just read one more.
I know.
And then they're like Pringles. You can't eat just one.
You are a teaser, that's for sure. A real mensch here.
Thank you.
Well, and let's, so that people understand, you're talking here about... really, I think you're too young. You were never in Beirut when it was beautiful. I don't know. It's been now so many years. The years have gone sort of all together.
Well, I might be older than you think. I was born in 67, but because of my Jewish background, I'm an evangelical. But I was never really allowed to go.
You never. You were. But before that, in the 50s.
Yeah, no, you're right. Beirut was the Paris of the Middle East, and Lebanon was the Switzerland of the Middle East. It was beautiful, and my brother-in-law is Lebanese. He was born and raised in Beirut. He grew up there during the Civil War in the 70s. He had to live in the, he and his family, in the hallway of their apartment because there were so many bombs going off, glass was flying. They couldn't just be a normal family. They eventually escaped and came to the United States, and he fell in love with my sister-in-law, and he's part of our family. So I actually dedicated the Beirut Protocol to this dear brother-in-law of mine, whose life was shaped by the terror, by the evil, by the horrors of all the forces that have destroyed Lebanon over the years. Lebanon's like a haunted house today. Beautiful once, and you can see how it was beautiful, but it's basically been devastated by war and terror, and it's like haunted by the ghosts of those who have come to occupy it.
It is
not a sovereign country
anymore.
No,
it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And my best friend, her parents had a home there, and I've seen the photos, and it was beautiful, and it's on a hill, and it had a view. And now so many different sides are there, and particularly, of course, Iran. And for Americans, Americans don't understand, you know, the difference between Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia. They think they're all, you know, Arabs. They're all Arabs. You tell that to an Iranian, and they go crazy.
That's true. They literally go ballistic.
They go ballistic. they really do. I've seen that happen. Somebody will say, "Oh, you're an Arab." And I say, "Oh my God!" I say, "Don't say that to them."
I know. I was once coming back from Iraq, visiting there when I was writing some novels about Iraq, and I'd taken a colleague, and we had dinner when we got back to Virginia with some Iranian friends. And this my friend who had been traveling with me, he didn't know the culture of the Middle East well. So he was eating this food that this Iranian wife had prepared, and he said, "Oh, this is fantastic. It's almost as good as what we had in Iraq." Oh my gosh! Her eyes just bulged out. I thought we were going to be in big trouble. We had to talk her down off the ledge.
I know. It's funny, and so they don't. But the importance of this region is it's so important. And if more people would understand the dynamics of why the Iranians hate the Saudis and why, you know, it's very complicated. So sort of like the Balkan countries, you know, but it's important.
Right. And we all know that we should know more about it. But, you know, it's complicated. And so you feel like, I don't know how to get into that fast-moving stream or river because, again, the current's moving so fast. So you're like, where do I start? What's my entry point into understanding? And that's what these thrillers can do. Again, they're written to entertain, but you get to see. I take you into the White House Situation Room, and you see the president and his national security advisors debating, why is this thing important and how are we going to react? Then I take you to the palace in Tehran as the supreme leader is making his decisions. I take you to the prime minister's office in Israel and the leader of terrorist organizations. And I keep moving you back and forth. So you see everybody's calculation, their strategies, their motives. And it's a way of learning, except that you don't feel like you're learning.
Exactly.
You feel like you're on a high-speed roller coaster ride.
Which that area is. I really just trying to understand it. But it's important. And I have hope for Iran. I do. I have hope that things will change. But it's all, you know, how much our own people understand it and where we're going with it. It's very important. And I don't know, you know, I don't want to say the end of this book leads to something great, but what we don't know what the next step is in this situation.
I think there's two. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I think there's two major dynamics happening in the Middle East right now, for real. One is that we're seeing the Abraham Accords being signed, historic peace treaties between Israel and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain and Morocco and Sudan. This is very exciting. We haven't seen peace treaties in 25 years, and now there's four with Israel in just the last few months. And I think a Saudi-Israeli peace treaty is coming, and that's part of what this novel is about. I think it's going to happen. But at the same time, the forces of evil are trying to blow up any pathway to peace. And so you've got two forces moving in opposite directions at the same time. And that's one of the dynamics that I try to capture in this new thriller, The Beirut Protocol. And we mentioned earlier, you mentioned how world leaders invite me to come and sit with them. I'm the only novelist that I know of that has sat with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, not just once but twice, talking about his fears and his concerns about the Iranian threat and his possible, maybe if someday he might make peace with Israel. I've met with the leaders of the UAE and the president of Egypt and the king of Jordan and the president of Israel. Like, most thriller writers don't get that chance. But I think those meetings have been so not only interesting personally, but they're also informing my novels in a way that really nobody else has had a chance to do.
It's true. You have all of this background, all of this knowledge, and it comes through really seamlessly. That's a perfect word for it. One doesn't realize what the lessons are learned, but it's not ever preachy or anything. It's just right there. You all filled with action, and I personally heard one day an Iranian say, "My happiest day in my life will be when we can bomb Saudi Arabia and Cairo off the map." And this is what people have to understand. Iran is different. And Iran, you have to understand Iran. And, you know, what? There's possibilities for peace, but we need a really, really smart people and people who are interested in the subject to understand the dangers that we face.
Well, that's right. And most Iranians are not looking for a war with the United States or Israel or the Saudis or the Egyptians. Most Iranians are so angry at their own government. The problem is the regime at the top of Iran that's so evil and is really enslaving the Iranian people. And there has been multiple efforts by the Iranian people to revolt, but they just can't. They keep getting squashed. So we have to find ways to nurture that pro-Western, pro-freedom, pro-peace, pro-moderation nation. But we have to remember the people at the top are hell-bent on destroying not just the United States, but Israel and our Arab allies.
Exactly.
And this is no time for weakness. Mm. There's no time for appeasement.
No, it's not. And as you said, the Iranian people are wonderful people, warm-hearted. They're great cooks. I love Iranian food.
Amen.
My goodness. But things have gotten to such a point where they really have real difficulty overcoming the evilness at the top, which really started right from day one when the Ayatollah took over Iran and he moved the PLO in, and they killed so many of the Iranian, the good Iranians. So we have a situation here, and I think people will just love what they learn in the Beirut Protocol. It's a great book, and then people can go back and read all of these wonderful books, because I think that one of my favorites is The Persian Gamble, which was book two, I think, right? Book two?
Yeah, that's right.
Book two. Oh, I love that one. And all of your books are just great. And, you know, Joel C. Rosenberg, you have a website, I think it's Joel C. Rosenberg, right?
JoelRosenberg.com.
Just Joel Rosenberg. Okay, JoelRosenberg.com.
That goes with it, and Twitter and Facebook feed. So, yeah, people can find out what the books are about. You could read the Persian, I'm sorry, I'm referring back to that one, the Beirut protocol. If that's your first one, people can get right into it.
You don't need
the backstory. But once, if you like it, then I would encourage you to go read the whole series.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I would.
See it unpack.
And then read some of Joel's other great books, including his nonfiction books, because, you know, you are absolutely terrific. And, you know, one of the things, I'm not political on this show. I don't do politics because, I can't take the emails one way or the other.
Right.
But as I said, you've spoken to so many absolutely wonderful and famous people, brilliant people, presidents and Saudi princes. But I think I would like you just to mention somebody who was in part of your life, early part of your life. And because this is a radio program, I think we should perhaps mention Rush Limbaugh.
Oh, well, absolutely. He was a dear friend. I met him first in 1993. He hired me in early 1994 to be his research director. And I worked for him for several years and learned so much from him. I don't know if he benefited from at all of me working for him. You know, I did work very hard for him, but he was so fascinating and he was so kind to me. When I first wrote my first novel, The Last Jihad, it was about a kamikaze attack against the United States by radical Muslim terrorists that leads to a war with Iraq. And it was all written before 9/11. But it came out after 9/11. And I sent him the manuscript, and I said, I'd love it if you would endorse it. Now, Rush, he was such a great guy, but he didn't endorse books by his staff. and he certainly didn't have him on his radio show. But he got so excited about that first novel of mine. He had me on the air. He literally single-handedly drove The Last Jihad up to number one on Amazon. It spent 11 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. And he, over the course of my career, almost 20 years, he was so supportive. And I just built a friendship with him, and I miss him. A year ago right now, he invited me to come see him because he was so ill, and we just wanted to see each other one more time. And it's sad to think that he is just that he's gone, but he became a follower of Jesus Christ late in his life, and I look forward to seeing him in heaven.
Well, you know, Joel, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. As I said, coming up to my anniversary, I can't think of anyone I wanted to speak to more than you. You are just amazing. Your books are fantastic. And the new book, Beirut Protocol, of course, is available wherever books are sold. And just thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
My pleasure. Shalom from Jerusalem. It's been great to be with you.
Okay. Shalom, shalom. Bye-bye now.
Wow. Bye-bye.
Okay. Ed, I think we'll go straight into my next interview, right? She's on the line. All right. We're just going to skip the commercial because I wanted to talk to Joel as much as I could, calling in from Israel. And now I'm going to go to a completely different type of book, an interesting book that I got several months ago, and I've been really several times. I've read the book when I got it, but then I've gone back over it, and I've noticed some really fascinating parts of the book that I wanted to talk to the author about. Jennifer Dupuy is I think I pronounced it right. Dupuy. Hi, Jennifer, are you there?
Dupuy, that's right.
Okay, Jennifer.
I'm here, yes.
Jennifer Dupuy. This is your first published book, and the name of the book is Little French Bridal Shop. Wow. As I said, I read it when I got it right away. Of course, I read, constantly, and I read it, and then, mm-hmm. I put it aside until, I got closer and closer to this interview. And I went back and I reread parts of it, and I must say that there are particular parts of it, and I think the handling of the way that you wrote about the men, although it's a story about a woman, and it's sort of, I suppose this would be considered a woman's fiction, I was impressed with the men in your book. Because lately I've been getting a lot of books where it's just, you know, a strong woman and not a very nice guys. So I've had a run of this. Like 2 years ago, I had a run of books where there were four girlfriends who were friends when they were, you know, teenagers, and then they lost contact over the years, and they come back, and it's because, you know, somebody covered up a murder or something. It was one of the, but it was always four women. And then the last year I was getting all these books where strong women and really evil. I mean, everybody, every man in the book, the little bratty kid, you know, they were all bad. And so it was so nice as I went back and I read it and I thought, well, that's nice. She's got a strong dad in this book.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, no, first off, Patsy, let me say thank you so much for having me. I'm so thrilled to be with you here today. And, you know, yeah, I've had many strong women in my life, I will say. My family is filled with strong women and many of them quite charismatic, and I think you see that in the book. But I'm glad you mentioned, because I do think this is not just a book for women, although it could be categorized as women's fiction. But I've had some strong male role models in my life, and I think the men in my book are layered, but they're likable and they're strong. And I think male readers could be drawn to this book as well.
Exactly. I mean, this is getting to be actually a problem where they have women's fiction and they put it in the women's department,
yes,
on the women's aisle. And,
yes,
you know, and,
yes,
and it's like, okay, well, Hemingway was a man's writer. We put him on the man's aisle. Don't you read that Hemingway guy? He is a strong guy. You know, you don't. You know, there's right. got to be a limit, because in the end, if good literature is good literature, and you know, and I want sort of this dynamic that it's shouldn't be just, because this story touches on subjects that are important to men too, a subject of dementia or Alzheimer's or whatever you want to call it. And this is as relevant to men who have to deal with the problem. And I think they would find a great deal of really not just strong, you know, understanding of the subject.
Yeah, no, and I'm so glad you said that, because I think, you know, the publishers are in a position in which they want to find the best way to market the book. And with this particular book, I think they did really market it as a woman's book. And I think the book will appeal to many women. But, you know, as I said earlier, and as you're saying now, the book deals with many subjects. So, you know, the book is set in motion when Larissa Pearl returns to her small seaside hometown upon the death of her great aunt Ursula. And she's in a, you know, she's a bit of a mess. She's just lost her job, and she's recently broken up with her boyfriend, and she's struggling with her mother's failing health. And on a whim, she wanders into the local bridal shop and buys a dress, even though she has no groom. And so soon word spreads all over this small town that she's getting married. And rather than dispel the rumor, she perpetuates it, and kind of small town chaos ensues. But there are a couple strong male characters in the book, in particular, the caretaker of the house which she's inherited. And he's been the longtime caretaker, and he's struggling with his own marriage. And, you know, you kind of see where that lands, and he's got triplet boys. There's some subjects that all readers would resonate with them. So the subject of dementia and caring for elderly parents, and also the subject of, you know, marriage gone into with the best intentions don't always go the way you want it to go.
And child rearing. And there's so many aspects to this book that I think everybody will find interesting. And it does start off, well, we'll talk in a minute about the house, but the whole premise where she tries on a wedding dress in a small town. Believe me, you shouldn't do that unless you're going to run with it. And of course, you ran with it. You really ran with it, because
yes,
they know everything in a small town. Really,
right,
when I used to go back home, you know, I would stop the first place I'd stop in town. By the time I got to the other end of the town, But he knew it. It was like, what? How do you know this already? Oh, you know that car. You have, you know, they already, oh, that's, they knew my, the car that I was driving. They knew, you know, every, so it's very funny. You don't do that in a small town unless you want to live with it. And she certainly does. And it's so funny. I have three wedding dresses. So I was.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. Well, I married the same guy three times. But each time I got a dress for it.
I love it.
Darn it. I love wedding dresses. I guess I love wedding dresses. I've still got them. You know? So that's, that sort of makes it, it sets it off as a sort of a funny premise. But there's, as it, we said, there's deep things going on in the town. And tell us just a little bit about Larissa Pearl. Why, how'd you pick the name even? It's interesting, the name.
Yeah, you know, the name came to me one day. There's no great secret behind it. I had been ruminating on names for a while, and somehow I thought of the name Larissa, and then this last name, Pearl, it kind of stuck with me. So there's no great secret behind that. But, you know, I will say, so as I started the opening pages, I kind of recognized that she was not herself. She's just returned to this house that she's inherited, and her great aunt, who's no longer alive for the action of the book, but she's really omnipresent in the book. She's really also like a character in the book, as is this house that she's inherited. So there's this great rambling house, and Larissa arrives there, and she thinks, oh, I can't deal with this house. I'm going to sell it. And there appears to be a leak in the wall, and she takes a crowbar to it. And it's a little bit drastic, you know? So we learn right away that she's kind of not really acting like herself. And of course, when she goes into the shop and buys the wedding dress, she's not acting like herself. And I realize that she's in a kind of a state of disillusionment and confusion. She's not thinking clearly. She's not quite herself. And I, you know, I recognize this state as something because it was something I deeply felt when I was grappling with my own mother's illness from breast cancer. And it's a feeling of when you're a caretaker for a parent, even when you're an adult and you're taking care of a parent, there's a very strong sense of kind of a role reversal, and it's intense, and you end up sort of playing a role with your parent that you're not used to playing, and with someone who's sort of losing pieces of themselves and their mind, like dementia, you have to become kind of more of the parent yourself, and it's striking when you go through that. And so I wanted, you know, as I began to delve into the writing, I realized that the story of Larissa's deception really was a vehicle to explore these feelings of loss of identity and disorientation and confusion that can consume a child, you know, as I said, even an adult child who becomes a caretaker of an ailing parent.
Well, you know, you tell this story so nicely. It's, you know, woven into the whole fabric of her personality, of what's going on with her life, and then of course, her parents. And as I said, I like her father very much. I like her father very much. And also Jack, you know, really great characters. But we'll come back to this house because now it does become a character in the house, you know, in the story too. And I was wondering if you had a house, you know, I come from a farm family, so we didn't have a fancy house. But I did have a girlfriend who had an aunt just like this, really with one of these fantastic houses, an old house that was like, for me, just visiting there was, I would be in awe. So did you have a house like this house?
Yeah, so there was a...
Explain about it. Explain the whole thing.
Yeah, no, I've always had a fascination with old houses and the stories that come with them. So, you know, I love books like... Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca with Manderley, this big house, and even like, you know, Jane Eyre and even Wuthering Heights or, you know, books like that have houses that are really memorable. And my grandmother grew up, lived in this small seaside community in Beverly Farms, which is north of Boston, Massachusetts. It's right next to Manchester by the Sea of the movie fame, Manchester by the Sea. And so although we didn't have a house like this in my family, she lived in these communities that were near these big houses, and she had some friends who had some big houses. So, you know, I could wander, you know, just like you were saying with one of your relatives' houses, your great aunt. I got to kind of peek into them now and then. And so I've always had this fascination with old houses. And in fact, when my husband and I first started dating, I discovered his love for old houses as well. And we often took neighborhood walks down nearby Elmhurst Road so that we could admire a historic house there. And so several years later, we were actually searching for a house, and this particular house went on the market, and we thought, oh my God, we can get the house. And by that time, I had started my novel, and I named my fictional house Elmhurst in tribute to the house on Elmhurst Road. So the house in the book is called Elmhurst after this specific house that we would walk by and admire. And long story short, we didn't get the house. Too many bidders, other people got it. But after 2 years of searching, we did end up with a lovely home of our own, and we're really thrilled with that.
Well, you set the the tone. The whole book is set with this house in mind, and we can imagine it. Now, when you this is your first published book, right. And I know my listeners are always fascinated to find out how you got to the point of being published. Because did you have to go through the query letter phase?
I sure did. Yeah. So. You know, it took a lot longer than I thought it would. I, as you mentioned, this is my first published novel. I started my first novel when I was 19. I'm in my late 40s now, so, it took longer than I thought. I wrote a short story in college, and my advanced fiction writing class, my freshman year of college, said, the people and the teacher said, you should just write a novel. So I spent a lot of time trying to wander and teach myself how to write a novel, and it was not this novel, I will say. But it did become my undergraduate thesis. But I had no idea what I was doing from the industry side. So there's a lot to learn about approaching the industry. And I was sending the book out directly to editors, and I was getting some interest. But really, I ought to have been sending query letters, as you mentioned, to agents. And it's all about really finding the right agent who can then find the right editor. So it's really a networking game, right, where your agent loves your book and can buy into your book and then can sell it to an editor who loves your book. So I wrote a couple other novels, and I had one that I had finished and was pitching, and I sent it to my now agent, Jacques de Spoelberg, and he asked for a one-week exclusive, which is a good sign. And he ultimately passed on that book, but he said, I really see something in your writing, and why don't we have a call? And he said, well, what are you working on now? And I had just started this book, The Little French Bridal Shop, and I was about three chapters in, and I pitched it to him, and I kind of had a strong sense, of where it was going. And he liked it, and we began to develop the book together, and I would kind of send him, it's told in three parts, and I would sort of send him each part as I was done with it to get his feedback. And, once I'd gone through that, and I had my agent, he sent it out, there were sort of two rounds of submission, but It went pretty well, so it was a good story in the end.
It is. It is a great story, and I think an encouraging story to all of my listeners who are writing, and many of them have started writing during this pandemic year. They sort of finally knuckled under. They had time, and they did start writing. But many of them don't understand the process that you do have. There is this process, and it is a networking system. And now, of course, your agent is you have to love him. You have to love him. Any guy who would say, okay, I'm interested, and you've only got three chapters, and I'm interested in you. I love this guy.
Yeah,
isn't he wonderful?
Oh, fantastic! Right, he took a chance, and he actually called me, which doesn't happen that often anymore. So that was, wonderful on its own.
Oh, it is. It is. You're right. It does not happen now. Now they don't even shoot you back an email usually. They put that little note. If you don't hear from us from 60 days, assume we're not interested in you already. Get over it.
Exactly.
So instead of which writer? Was it Margaret George? I had one writer on, and she said, "Oh, it was so wonderful in the olden days. They used to send me these these lovely letters from New York City, with rejections, but they were written on beautiful paper, lovely, letterhead. I wish I had saved them." Mm-hmm. He saw the right thing, that you're a fine writer, you've gotten some really nice reception, nice things, feedback from important people. So it's really must be thrilling for you, and I'm sure that you are working on on the next book? Because once you find this joy on paper, isn't it right that once you find that joy on paper, you just can't stop?
Oh, there's no way I would stop. It's a pleasure and a challenge to which I'll always return. Absolutely. You said it. You said it, Patty.
And the thing is, the characters, while you're doing it, the characters are part of your life, and they get
absolutely
to be, and I can imagine that really, she became so real to you that you're like, and the house, you're like, I'm walking around this house, and Larissa Pearl's with me, and and if I don't write this book, she's going to come after me. So, isn't it exciting?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the house, another quick tangent I'll tell you here. When I had just started the book, and I did have a really strong sense of the house, and it's in my mind for sure, both exterior and interior. And one of the first things I wrote, I had treated myself to a writing weekend also on the North Shore of Boston in a little town, seaside town, again, called Rockport, Massachusetts. And I was in a little inn there called the Emerson Inn, and I had just settled into what I hoped would be some meaningful writing. But I kept finding myself distracted by this large pattern, repeating pattern wallpaper of pheasants. And, I couldn't stop laughing when I looked at them, and I couldn't stop looking. So I began to write the wallpaper into my manuscript. And then flash forward several months later, when I began to revise that scene, I realized, oh my God, I didn't take a picture. And, writers being obsessive as we are, I began to search for the wallpaper online, Emerson Inn wallpaper, how can I find it? And I kept finding people's wedding pictures with it. So this was hilarious on its own. I had all these people's wedding pictures with the wallpaper in the background. But of course, the wallpaper wasn't in focus because, they were focused on the wedding celebrants, of course.
Yeah, what's important?
So I then called the inn and I said, can you just snap a photo of this wallpaper for me? And they said, oh, well, guess what? The dining room where that wallpaper was is under construction. They're renovating it and they're tearing down the wallpaper. But we have, can you believe it? So but we have some scraps of it.
Oh.
If you want, you can come and get. So I went and retrieved, 4x3 piece of this wallpaper, and I had a little frame piece of it that sat with me in my office as I worked and revised and developed this book.
Oh, isn't that a delightful story? That is so sweet.
Yeah.
I love it. Oh, wow. Now, do you have a website that you want people to go to?
I do.
And do you have a picture
Absolutely.
Of that on your website?
Yes, I do. The picture of the wallpaper is on the website. There's also a very interesting flower called the Night Blooming Cereus that's in the book, and there's a picture of that on the website.
Yes.
My website is jenniferdupe.com. So Jennifer with two N's, J-E-N-N-I-F-E-R, Dupe, D-U-P-E-E.com.
Okay. Well, I think people will really enjoy the book. As I said, you have a sense of humor, so there's humor in it,
mm-hmm.
But there's also this other part that I think it's a kind of book that you read, and I think people will really enjoy it, and feel good that they've read it and be interested in what happens to Larissa from the minute she puts on that wedding dress. You want to know what in the heck is going to happen with her. So you did a great job, Jennifer.
Thank you. Yeah. No, I was going to say that I do think there's quite a bit of humor in it. I think it's funny. I hope readers will find it funny. And though the book tackles some difficult subjects, it's ultimately really a hopeful book. And I think readers will come away with it with a sense of renewal and a promise, especially in hard times like these, right?
Exactly.
That we can find relief in facing our vulnerabilities and really connecting with those we love.
Yeah, that's the important thing. The whole message is connect with the ones that you love. And you do it here. And again, a wonderful father figure, one who really is strong and it brings tears to my eyes to think about it. But I love it.
Aww.
And I think you did a great job. And I know you will be back with your next book soon.
I'll be back for sure.
Okay.
Now.
Okay. And give your agent a big hug when we can finally start hugging people again. Because he did the right thing in calling you and getting this book published for you.
Aww. Well, thank you so much, Kathy. It's been such a pleasure.
It's been a joy to talk to you. Bye-bye now.
Take care.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, she's nice. Wow. Can you imagine? Somebody walks in to a dress store and just tries on a wedding dress, and she's not engaged. And, she doesn't have anybody to get married to. Well, what the heck? Why not? You can live in hope. That's what you have to do. You live in hope. And of course, if you have enough money, you can actually buy the dress and keep it for a while, and you never know what's going to happen. It's funny. Anyway, that's an interesting book, and it's called Little French Bridal Shop and Jennifer Dupuy. But also, I want to again talk about Joel C. Rosenberg's The Beirut Protocol. Really an excellent book, a book that for me, it brought back a lot of memories and a lot of the thinking about this whole situation in the Middle East. And if you want to sort of it's a primer on the Middle East, you get that while you're having a real adventure. And there are lots of twists and turns. And of course, Marcus Riker is a great character that Joel has developed, and I'm sure that you will enjoy it. Okay, my anniversary program is coming up next week, and it is going to be really great because Tasha Alexander is my guest for the entire hour. It is so wonderful to have her back this year. She's been on before, of course, but this year I'm going to have her for the entire hour to talk about not just her most recent book, but also her entire series, the Lady Emily series, because if you read the Lady Emily series, you can have a grand tour of Europe. Nobody can travel this year to Europe, but read Tasha Alexander's books and you have a grand tour. She takes you all over Europe, starting in London, and then you head off in all directions to St. Petersburg, to Vienna, to Venice, to Rome, to Paris, to Berlin, all over the continent. And it is really, truly a grand tour in the olden day fashion, going from wonderful city to wonderful city, learning about the people, learning about the countries, and learning about the food. And she's going to be here next week, next Tuesday. Then, just everybody, remember what I always tell everyone. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or perhaps a movie on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't know unless you start writing. So start writing today and you see what happens. And meanwhile, make sure, I have to just say, hello, Kanisha. One little, I'm throwing you a kiss on the YouTube. I love you. And Kanisha had some great news, and I'll be talking about that again next week. Anyway, I'm going to say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed, for everything. And he's saluting me. I'm saluting him. And as I said, I should have been a general, just like Winston Churchill wanted to be, because we would both make great generals, that's for sure. Anyway, everybody, have a wonderful day, and mark your calendar for next Tuesday, the anniversary program of Joy on Paper. Bye-bye now.